My name is Bea and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Can you all hear me over there? Oh, I'm so self-centered that it would be terrible if you didn't, you know. You might miss something. You might never stay sober. Well, I'm not going to let you out of here until midnight, so I'm going to take my coat off. Is it too loud? Oh, okay. Is that better? I'll do my best to be perfect, but I don't think it's going to work. I want you to tell you that I'm grateful to you for inviting me back. It's always a great compliment when I'm asked to come to someplace a second time, because in my other life, I think when people had a little dose of me, then they didn't want me anymore. So in AA, I get to go and meet people all over again, and it's really exciting. My story hasn't changed very much. As a matter of fact, my recovery has changed a little bit, but the story of my drinking is the most boring one you're ever going to hear if you haven't heard it before. And so I encourage you to have a little nap until I get to the part where I talk about my recovery. As most of you have heard many times, my life was marvelous until I was two. And it just all seemed to fall apart because I have a problem, and it's called people. You know, people just won't do it the way they're supposed to. I don't know why. They won't fit into my plan for things, and I think I know the plan there is for everything. And for some reason, the people in the world out there, you know, where they are in the streets and all, they don't seem to do it the way they're supposed to. And this was manifested to me when I was two, because what happened in my family was that my little sister was born. And they didn't ask my permission for that. As you can tell by now, those of you who don't know, I was born and raised in Ireland. That's why I have this disease. It's called the Irish disease. And you can get it if you're Norwegian, I think, and you can get it if you're Italian and Spanish and African. You know, other people have gotten our disease from us in Ireland, but it's basically the Irish disease. I'm always delighted when I come to a place. I tell everybody across this country about AA in Dallas. This is my favorite place to be. And that's not BS. That's the truth. I love the Dallas AA. There's something very serious about the way you work your program and the way you work your steps, and it's always impressive to me. Anyway, this little girl was born, and I didn't like her. You know, she didn't have freckles. I have some freckles here that I don't care for. I can't do anything about them now. I'm beginning to accept them. And I guess there's not much I can do now. And she didn't have red hair, you know. And she just seemed to be the epitome of beauty. And my parents spent a lot of time worshiping her. And it felt to me that they were leaving me out. Now, I know that you always have felt included. I can tell by looking at your faces. You've never felt lonely in your lives. You've always known what it has felt like to fit in, you know. Well, I never knew anything about fitting in. I still know very little about fitting in. And so in my family, what they did every year, my parents, they had babies every year. And we had a new one every single year, and then we ended up with five of us. And just shortly after the fifth baby was born, my father went to work one day and he never came home. He was killed in an accident. And I didn't know how to do grief or mourning or loss or any of the things that we get to learn about today. But all I knew that my father, whom I worshipped, was gone. And my mother was a public school teacher, and she took me aside one day and she said, "Bea, I want you to help me to raise these children." And if you're an oldest child, you might identify with some of the feeling that I had then, but I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know what that meant, to get a lot of responsibility. And my mother was a very purposeful kind of woman. She is a very goal-oriented woman even today. And in fact, there's a little paragraph in the big book, and my mother prepared me for this paragraph, and it says, "Is she not a victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only she manages well?" And my mother taught me how to manage well. She taught me how to clean and cook and babysit, and she just knew that if she educated all of us, that when we became 32 like she was, we would not be widowed, and or at least if we were, we would have something we could do. And she believed in education. That was her big thing. And so I took care of those kids, and I went to school, and I worked hard, and I never was a kid. I put away my dolls, and I never played. And when I got into my teenage years, I did what most of you have done. Some of you look like you're still there. Wonderful young group here. It's very exciting for me to see that. And what I decided to do in my teenage years, I decided to become a saint. Now, it's always offensive to me when they read it out of the big book and they say we're not saints. You know how they read that out of chapter 5? And what I did in trying to become a saint was, what I did was I became a Catholic nun, which I am doing today. I'm doing Catholic nun for a long time. In fact, in July of this year, I will have been 40 years a Catholic nun. Now, if there's anybody here in this room who has a resentment against somebody like me, I want you to know right from the word go that I didn't do it to you, okay? There's my friend over there. See, I always have one or two who have resentment about people like me. You're mad at some nun or some priest or some pope, and you think it's my fault, don't you? Wrong. I didn't do it to you, folks. So it gets me off the hook, and I tell you that straight away. Now, those of you who are recovering Catholics will appreciate that, and those of you who are not recovering Catholics, you might be wondering, well, what happened to her? How did she get the booze? Long story. So sit tight and make yourselves comfortable. So I became this little nunny bunny in the year 1950. And I loved it. I still do. I love this living. I love this life I do. I'm very interested in it. I always have been. I think I was cut out to be this kind of a person. And then what I did was they sent me on to school. They sent me over to England, the nunny bunnies did, over to England to finish my education at the University of London. And that was a kind of a prestigious school to become part of or to graduate from. And when I was finished there, funny thing happened to me was that I got to thinking that I knew all there was to know about everything. You know what I mean? Like I knew everything about early childhood education, about primary education, about secondary education, about college. I just got to know a lot of stuff, and I became kind of sort of grandiose and a little bit that thing that we call arrogant. You look like you don't have that here in Dallas, but I have a lot of that, arrogance, where I don't like anybody to tell me what to do. And so I graduated from there with flying colors, and I was assigned to teach in a public school in England, and I love teaching. Still love to teach, although I don't get to do it in the same form as I used to. But I love teaching little kids. I loved opening their little minds and helping them to envision what their life journey would be, and oh, I used to have a lot of fun with little kids. But a very, very strange thing happened between my ears, which I believe is called my head. I'm not sure what it is, but that's what they tell you in the program, it's called your head. A voice would go off on a regular basis in my head, and the voice would say, if only they would shape up, I would feel better. If only they would do it differently, or if only I could be someplace else, then I'd feel better inside. And it seemed that I wanted the rest of the universe in some form or shape to do it differently from the way they were doing it. And I was positive if I could get that to work, if I could get that in sync, then I'd be okay. And so one day I came home from school after teaching a whole day, and there was a letter on our bulletin board, and the letter said, would any of you sisters here like to volunteer and go to California? Well, being as dramatic and histrionic as I am, I thought I belonged in Hollywood anyway. You know, I just did. And I ended up signing up and volunteering, and they picked me, which I thought was awfully good taste on their part. And not only that, but they told me that I was going to be in charge. Now, there's nothing better that an alcoholic likes than to be in charge. You know, we like to have control of things, either covertly or overtly. Well, I'm one of your more overt types, as you'll know of, and if you stay here for this weekend, you'll know that when I say things, I usually want them done, like I say it, you know? And so I got to California, and they told me I was going to be in charge of the school. I was going to be the principal of the school, and they were going to put me in charge of all the nunny bunnies. That meant I was going to be the mother superior. And so, welcome. Come on in.
Thank you.
And so I arrived in Southern California on the 16th of August, 1964. And in those times, we were wearing all the nunny clothes. Have you ever seen pictures of us? Have you ever seen somebody like me dressed up, you know, as a nunny bunny? With all the white stuff over my head and the black, long black wool serge. Boy, it was hot in California on the 16th of August, 1964. But I knew it was going to be okay because I was in charge. And everything was wonderful in my life for about 5 days. And after 5 days, I was to meet somebody who afterwards was to be my arch enemy until, oh, I think it was like the day before yesterday. And he was known as the pastor. And he was the priest in charge of that whole plant and stuff. And I got to learn something awfully quick, that he was in charge of the finances and the money. And he thought he was in charge of everything, and he thought he was the boss, and I knew I was the boss, and immediately we locked horns. You know, we just didn't get along. And he came from an Irish background, and we just didn't like each other at all. I mean, really, at all. And so we started to fight, and I started to think about how I could get rid of him, and I started to think about writing letters about him, and oh, it was real hard. And one day, a wonderful thing happened to me. And if you're like I am, you'll remember the day that you got your first drink or your first fix or your first whatever it was that took away your pain. And the way it happened to me was that this lady came to my office. I was the school principal. And she said, "It's very hot today. We're having the Santa Ana wind there." And she said, "Would you, all the sisters like to come over and swim in our swimming pool?" And so we did, and we took off our nunny clothes and got into our swimsuits, and we had a wonderful time. And she came to the side of the pool with a tray and a large pitcher and some glasses. And on the top of the glasses, there was salt. You're so smart, boy. You know what was in the pitcher, don't you? You're bright here, I'm glad. Because I say that because in England, they don't know what I'm talking about. When I tell this story in England, they go, "Nyeh," goes right over their heads. And my personal opinion is that if you haven't had a margarita, you don't qualify yet, you know. That's just off the record, you know. It doesn't matter. Certainly was the drug of my choice. And so I took a few slurps or slugs. I never did sip. I didn't know how to do that. They never taught me how to sip. And I just knew that I must have died and that I went straight to heaven. That's the feeling I had. It was marvelous. And I knew for sure that if I could continue to get this stuff for the rest of my life, that everything would be fine, you know. The nunny bunnies who were working for me, they would work harder, or I would feel better about them, and the kids I taught, or the kids everybody else taught, the teachers in the school, everything would seem better. And so before I left the lady's house, I asked her for the recipe. And she gave me the recipe to take home. And if you're new here, if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you may or may not know that denial is built into this disease. And I thought that the nicest thing I could possibly do for the other nunny bunnies that I lived with and worked with, and I was their superior, I thought the nicest thing I could do for these people was to whip up this little beverage on a regular basis when I could get the ingredients and, you know, and give it to them, because they worked hard for me. And if they didn't finish what they were drinking, that I could have their leftovers kind of thing. You know, that's just how it was. And it was hard for me to get the ingredients. It really was hard. But one day the pastor came over to visit us, and he said, "Is there anything that you need?" Now, when he did that, he always thought I needed a new table or 6 new chairs for the 8th grade classroom or a new clock or something, you know, like furniture, because I thought that if I could get things, that that would help me to feel better, too. And so I said to him, yes, as a matter of fact, there is something we need. We would like to have a bottle of tequila. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget the look in his face, but it changed into kind of joy. Tequila was kind of easy, he thought. So he went away, and he came back in about 4.5 minutes, and he had... he had a bottle of tequila, and I think he got that where they manufactured it, which was in the rectory where he lived. Now, I'm not sure. I'm not real sure about that, but I think that that's what happened. And he said, you like this stuff? And I said, yes, we do. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, next Sunday we're having this little get-together in the rectory. We're having the priests in the area coming over for dinner, and we're having a little steak and, you know, a glass of wine. And, oh, God, this sounded so wonderful to me. And just out of, it doesn't make any difference to anybody here, I'm sure, but just to, for any of you that would be interested, to put you into some kind of an historical setting, there was a movement happening in our church at the time. It was called Vatican II. And that meant that this little roly-poly pope over in Rome had become pope, and everybody thought he was no good and he was going to die soon. But what he did was marvelous. He went over to the windows of the Vatican, and he opened the Vatican windows. He says, God, it's awful stuffy in here. Still is, but, you know. And he said, let's get a bit of fresh air into this church, and let's modify some of those rules and start thinking about what's in our hearts and not be too particular about externals and all of that. And what I thought he meant was that we could drink. You know, I really thought he meant that Sister B could drink. I really believed that that's what it was all about. So we went over to visit the pastor and his friends for dinner that next Sunday. And I found out some wonderful things there. I found out that he had bourbon, and he had a thing called scotch, and he had vodka, and he had all kinds of wine, and he had after-dinner drinks. And I thought, well, goodness gracious me, I've got to get friends with him. And I've got to work hard for him, and I've got to do whatever it is that he wants me to do as the school principal. And I decided that I was going to stay close and do everything, whatever it was that he needed and wanted. And I was going to work well with this man, very well. And I think the book calls it Seeking Lore Companions. But anyway, I decided to stick in with him anyway and stay close, and I would get my beverage on a regular basis. And so my drinking began. Now, I have some wonderful drinking stories, and I'm sure you'll hear some of them if some of you come back here over the weekend. But some of my favorite ones are that there was this man in our parish, and he had a trailer down in Ensenada. And he said to us one day, if you ever want to use that trailer, you can use it anytime we're not using it. And I went into the Nunny Bunnies and I said to them, you know what? More than 50% of the people in Southern California are going to be Hispanic within the next few years. So every time we get the opportunity, we need to go down to Mexico to learn Spanish. But when he was giving me the keys of his little trailer, he said, Sister, this is the key of the front door, and this is the key of the cabana, and Sister, this is the key of the liquor cabinet. Help yourself. Aren't those magic words to an alcoholic? And I remember the prayer I prayed, and I said, praise God from whom all blessings flow. And I got myself down there as often as I could and as quickly as I could on long weekends and short weekends, little holidays and big holidays, mini holidays and maxi holidays, and every time I could get down there. And that's how the beginning part of my drinking started. And I just thought it would be absolutely wonderful to be able to drink like a lady, to get this nice feeling of just, you know, that some of you know what I'm talking about, don't you? You do? I don't feel alone here, like that mellow, you know, where it was just, just that little click where it was going to be okay. I just knew I was always going to get it within 15 minutes, but it never quite stayed, you know, that feeling. And so it became increasingly more necessary for me to procure my alcohol. And my superior sent me over to Australia during these years when I was trying to do what the book says we can't do, which is control and enjoy my drinking. And I remember in Australia they said to me, first of all, they didn't ever, ever offer me a drink. I never could understand that. I thought it was awfully, what kind of mean of the people in Australia. I was doing a kind of a seminar with our sisters there, and this little sister said to me about the day or so before I left, she said, is there anything that I could get you? You look like you're awfully tired. And what she wanted to tell me was that I was becoming a little bitch, because it was real irritable, you know. And she said, could I get you something? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I said, you could. I really would like to have a drink. And she went to the medicine cabinet, and she brought me this bottle that I think they had there for at least 100 years. And she gave it to me, and she said, of course, help you. And I think she meant that I was just going to take a little drop for medicinal reasons like the rest of the nuns did and give her back the bottle. Well, she never got the bottle back. And she always remembers that. I saw her. I was over there in the last couple of months, and she always remembers that I never gave her the bottle back. And my drinking career started, and it progressed, and it got worse. And what happened to me, folks, was what I'm sure happened to you, whether you're drinking or using or whatever, was that I died a little bit inside. And our co-founder, Bill W., talks about that rather well in page 8 of the big book, where he says that no words can describe the loneliness. You know, that cut-off feeling that we have from the rest of society, from ourselves, from the people around us, from our loved ones. We have a kind of a cut-off feeling from everybody. And we don't know what it is that's wrong with us. We just don't know what that is. And he says that no words can describe that loneliness. And it would be always is awfully interesting to me when I see a group as large as yours. And I would love to be starting here and go all around this room and into all these other rooms and ask each of you on a one-on-one, how did you die? Do you remember where you were? Do you remember, were you in your kitchen? Were you in jail? Were you in a hospital? Were you on the side of the road on the freeway? Where were you when you were dying? Can you remember that? And we'd have an accumulation of a lot of miracles here, because the fact is we're sitting here tonight, and by the grace of God, we're sober and clean. And it's always very touching to me that can happen. Well, wherever you were, I don't know where that was at all, as a matter of fact, but I'm here to tell you that I was in a very sheltered environment. I was in a building, a place, a home that was called my convent, where I live. And I was living there with beautiful people, prayerful people, kind people, people who wished me well, people who wanted me to be okay, and people who were very good to me. And I was dying, and I never knew about people like you. I knew alcoholics were people who got drunk, and they would lie under a bridge at night, and they'd have a bottle in a sack, and they were dirty. That's basically what I thought an alcoholic was. And I certainly didn't ever want to become an alcoholic. So see, I set out to do the thing that our book says we can't do. I set out to control and enjoy my drinking. And the book says it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And I tried real hard to do those two things together. Now, one of the things that I did, two things basically to try to do this. Once I tried to quit. Did you ever try to quit by yourself? Didn't last very long, but I did try. And I remember going to the doctor and telling him that I thought I was having a nervous breakdown, because I was shaking and I was perspiring and I was crying, and I said, I think I'm having a nervous breakdown. And so he was very obliging, and he gave me some little pills there that I could have. One was called Valium, and the other one was called Librium. And then eventually, I think he gave me Elevil and Stelazine first, and then he graduated me into the other two. And so I had open prescriptions for those four drugs. Now, for some reason, I didn't get hooked on prescription drugs, because I always felt like the music on Twilight Zone, you know? Nee, 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 you know, really way out there. The music, the light's on, but there's nobody home kind of feeling. And I like to be in control. And so for some reason I got rid of the prescription drugs and I went back drinking again. I thought that made more sense, you know, that, you know, drinking was much less serious to my system. And then I did another thing besides giving up alcohol. I thought that I would try to pray more. Don't you try to pray when you're drinking or using and try to wonder, you know, I never had a problem with God in the sense that I believed that there was a God. But I believed that God was God and that I was Mrs. God. And so therefore, I was in charge. You know, I was just in charge of the relationship, basically. And I used to call out things I wanted God to do and write them down and draw his attention to them and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I just basically always telling God what to do. And I never had a kind of any sort of a mutual relationship with God, even though I had prayed the Our Father for years. I never thought of what Thy will be done meant until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. It just never dawned on me. I don't know why. I used to give workshops on God's will. you know, it's kind of embarrassing. It's really embarrassing. I never connected any of this stuff. I didn't know I had a disease. I really didn't. I want to tell you this because usually in a group this large, there's usually one person at least who might have been or is at this moment angry with God. Might be just one tonight. So I'm going to tell you this. I was very upset with God because, you see, I used to go to bed at probably 10 o'clock at night with a little something to help me to sleep. I suffered from grave insomnia. I mean grave insomnia, in that I couldn't sleep for years before I got sober. And I go in and out of insomnia even yet, although I'm much better than I used to be. But insomnia is something that's very, very, very close. I mean, I know all about that. And so I used to wake up at like 2:12 on the digital clock. It was never like 2:15. It was always like 2:12. And I knew only alcoholics would drink in the middle of the night like that. And plus, I never knew if we had any, and mostly we wouldn't have any because, you know, well, you know, it would be all gone from the time before. And what I would do would be I would try to pray. And I used to go down to our little chapel that we have in our convent on the first floor, and I'd go into the chapel. And I was so angry because I couldn't not drink. I couldn't not drink. And what I used to do when I went to the chapel, I used to give God the finger. And I was taught how to do that by the 7th and 8th graders that I used to teach. So I got to know more things since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's what I knew then. And I used to be really, really angry with God. And I just didn't know why this whole thing didn't measure up. I just couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I never felt I quite fitted in, and I was always craving alcohol, and when I drank, I was always getting in trouble. And I never could understand the nunny bunnies. I really couldn't. Now, we would have these little, like, birthday celebrations or anniversaries or whatever, and I was always cooking them up. I would say, well, didn't you have a birthday last week? And they'd say, oh, no, that was 6 months ago. I said, let's celebrate. Let's do it again, you know, let's do it. And they'd say, oh, that's kind of funny, but we did it anyhow, you know. They wouldn't think of questioning their superior, you know. And we would do it anyhow, and we would have this little... I always thought the word celebration was a nice word. It had a little, like, liturgical ring to it. It wasn't like, let's all get drunk this evening, girls, you know. We didn't do it that way. It was just like, let's be nice. And when they heard the word celebrate, I think they meant, like, kick back and watch a movie, maybe, and visit and eat peanuts and... And then they would say weird things like, well, I think we have these little glasses. God, little glasses. And they would always want these little glasses. And I was never interested in anything little when I was drinking. I was interested in large containers, like a flower pot maybe, or something. Something that would hold a lot. Didn't matter what it was. I wasn't a bit graceful. But anyway, they would take their little glasses and they'd sip. And then they would do something that I never understood. They would leave it down. You know, God, can you understand that? You know, to this day, I travel nearly every single weekend somewhere in these United States, and I see people doing that on the airplane. They'll ask for whatever, and they'll let it sit. God, what a sin, you know, I mean, jeez. And you know, when there's a little turbulence and the little airline stewardess runs around to pick up everything, they'll send them back and they're not even finished. You know, I cannot understand anyone who wouldn't finish their drink. Well, then anybody's never finished their drinks. And so when they were, what they thought was finished, I would come around behind them and I'd take their leftovers and I'd put it away so that I could get it when I needed it. But it was becoming more and more scarce, and I just didn't know what to do, and I didn't know where to go, and I didn't know who to tell, and I was working, like, trying to do about three jobs. I was doing like a juggler, because I was overcompensating for the way I felt. Oh, the guilt was dreadful, this big secret I was carrying around, that I wanted to drink more than I wanted to do anything in the wide world, but I didn't know about how I could tell anybody that. And one day I was reading this little pamphlet that comes to our house every single month. It's called Sisters Today. And on the very back page there was an ad. And the ad said, "Are you concerned about your drinking, sister? If so, please call this number, collect." Well, I figured that out of 140,000 sisters in the United States, that there must be one other sister who had a problem with alcohol besides myself. See, I'm terminally unique, as you'll probably learn as these days progress. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe at least I could make a phone call and I could ask about it. Now, I want you to know, in case any of you are still doing this, I want you to know that I had no intention in this wide earthly world of abstaining from alcohol. That was not in my mindset at all. I just thought if I could make this phone call, they could tell me how to control and enjoy it, even though I wasn't using that language at the time. But you know, I could get the recipe down so that I wouldn't have to be foolish, I wouldn't have to be depressed, I wouldn't have to be guilty, I wouldn't have to be crying, I wouldn't have to be making a fool out of myself, I wouldn't have to be dancing the Irish jig on the dining room table in my long habit in front of all the sisters, you know, even when it wasn't St. Patrick's Day, you know? And they'd say things to me the next day, "Oh, that was funny last night." I'd say, "Excuse me? What? It was funny last night?" And, "Oh, God, you know how you have to do your tracks over, you know, about what you did? Oh, thank you, God, that I don't have to do that again." But anyway, I made this phone call to Massachusetts. It was like 3 hours away from, 3 hours difference in the time from California. So I made the phone call, and this lady answered me. And I told her that I had some questions about this ad I had just read. And she said, "Well, what were they?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to be getting a new job." And that was true. I told her that part was the truth. But all the rest of what I told her was lies. I couldn't tell the truth to her. And I said to her, "I'm very concerned because my new job is that I'm going to be working with priests and nuns in the diocese. I'm going to get this administration job in the diocese. And I'm very concerned because I know a lot of them who are drinkers. And maybe you can help me." So she said, "Oh, I certainly can." So she told me about recovery hospitals. In fact, that's what that place was, a recovery hospital for priests and sisters. And she told me about literature, and she said she would send me some literature. And then she told me about an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, being as smart as I was, that if I could learn the recipe from her, how not to do it the way I was doing it, that somehow I could learn, you know, how to control and enjoy my drinking. But before I finished the conversation, she said, "Sister, would you like to tell me a little bit about your own drinking?" They're very smart in Massachusetts. Don't ever go there. Very smart. And then she said a wonderful thing, which I will always remember, and I think it's probably what the greatest gift of our program is. She said, "Because I can hear pain in your voice." And you know, we get to do that. We get to hear the pain in one another's voices on the telephone. We get to hear the pain in one another's voices as we share. And we get to see the pain in one another's faces. And then, because we can do that as a result of the program, we get to help to heal one another. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So exciting. God, it's so exciting. I get very turned on about Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the greatest event that has ever hit, you know, this whole century. It's just a marvelous, marvelous tribute to what can happen in the world and to what human beings could have through the grace of God and through God's inspiration, could have brought about this wonderful program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, she told me all this stuff, and I just knew, and then I finally was able to do the miracle that we get to do, too, when we get into some kind of willingness. I got to break down. I broke down into the telephone. I started to sob and cry. And I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to tell. I don't know anybody. I assured her that I was very clever. Oh, man. I was so brilliant. I told her all about my degrees and, oh, God, how important I was and how my name was in the paper last week. And, oh, Lord. And she said, well, you know what? You might want to go to an AA meeting just to see if you qualify, if you could listen to the feelings. And, oh, I thought, God, I could never go to AA, because if I did, I probably would meet a mom or a dad or a kid that I taught, like, in the last century or something. And I was scared. I really was so scared. But I couldn't get her conversation out of my mind. And so the next day I called Alcoholics Anonymous in a place called Whittier in California, which is quite a distance from where I live in Orange County. And maybe some of you have been to Whittier. God. Well, anyway, I called, and I remember exactly what I did. It was a Wednesday morning. And at the time, we were wearing a kind of a modified nunny habit. And I changed from nunny clothes into regular clothes, and I put on a whole bunch of eye makeup, and I went down to this place in Whittier called Serenity Hall. Well, now, believe me, Serenity Hall in Whittier was anything like a Serenity place, if you know what I mean. It was a tiny little room, it seemed, and it was very smoky, and it was full of little old men, and they all seemed like they were shuffling all over the floor. Just what it felt like. And I got in there, and I sat down, and I was petrified. And there was one man, and he was standing at the podium, and he was sharing his experience, strength, and hope. And the first thing he said was that he would sign court cards after the meeting. Well, now, I did not know what a court card was. So I thought I'd have to go out and get a court card so that I could go back and get a member to be a member of the club. But anyway, I sat on in that chair, and I was petrified. I remember holding on to the chair, and I was just very uncomfortable. And this man became kind of fascinating to me, because he was using language that I used to punish the eighth graders for using when they were in about the eighth grade. They used to start using these words. And he used a word regularly that starts with sh. You might have heard it here. Hardly, though. I don't think so. And he used that a number of times. And then what happened was he graduated into another word that starts with f. Oh, big bad word. You know, in his regular vocabulary as he's talking, you know. In fact, he was using f, the f word, in sentences. And he was using the f word as different parts of speech, like as adverbs and verbs and prepositions and conjunctions and, you know. And he used the f word with ing on the end and ed on the end. And he also used it once with the word mother before it. And I can remember thinking, and this is going to be my spiritual leader for the rest of my life. Oh, I thought, you know. And then when he was all through, he said, keep coming back, it works. And I would always remember what I did. I remember, oh, God, I remember getting into the car to go home, and I was crying hard. Oh, and I looked in the mirror, and this stuff that I put in my eyes was coming down my face. And I said the sh word and the f word all the way home to the car lift. I really did. I don't advocate those words, but between friends, and I'm far enough away from home to say this, they're no substitute sometimes. You know what I mean? But, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of weird. It really is. And if you're new, I have to tell you, I have to be real upfront with you about this at the beginning. It's kind of strange, because they tell you weird things. They tell you, like, don't drink. God, imagine, don't drink. Now, I got sober on the 2nd of December, 1978. And I didn't think that there was any way that you could do Christmas and not drink, because Christmas in my life was the only legal time that I could, you know, drink without somebody asking me something, or it's just awful. And they were saying, don't drink, don't use drugs. And then they were saying, go to meetings, you know. And I have in my bottom drawer, I have a whole bunch of pieces of paper. They're called degrees. And I thought I was kind of smart. That's why this arrogant thing is a real problem for me. And I thought, why would I be going to meetings to be among people like you when I know so much? You know, I mean, God, I know all this stuff. There's nothing that I can learn at meetings that's going to help me. So I won't be doing that part. And then they said, read the book. Now, I'm an English major. That's one of my majors from the University of London. And when I read this book to begin with, I didn't like the way they wrote this book at all. The grammar's not that good in it in some places, and the sentences need to be reconstructed. And so what I did was I took the book to the beach one day, and I did that. I corrected it. So that you'd all have it. Some of you can have my new edition anytime you want it. They never seem to want it anyplace else, so if you want it, I'll give it to you. But I can remember going down to Serenity Hall in Whittier and telling them all this, telling them that the syntax offended my sensibilities as an English major from the University of London. And, oh, God. And they said, keep coming back, Bea, you know, just God. Oh, I'm so embarrassed when I think of those first years. And then they said, get a sponsor. Well, now, I couldn't get a sponsor now. I'm sure all of you did all these things the first day, but I couldn't do any of this stuff. They said, get a sponsor. And I didn't trust anybody, so I couldn't get a sponsor. How can you get a sponsor when you don't trust anybody? And they were saying, you know, and these women, you know, God, I hated the women. I just thought the women had nothing, you know, they had nothing else to do only sit around and crochet Afghans. That's what they do in California, some of them, you know, they crochet, and they had these smiles in their face, they'd nod, and everything was like, okay. Everything was like, and they were always talking about the fact that as soon as they walked into AA, they were home. Oh, yeah. I just hated it. And so what I did was I interviewed women, and I temporarily hired them, and then I fired them when they weren't doing what I thought they should be doing. And then they were telling me, "Hey, you work these steps." They had steps in the wall just like this, and I didn't think there was anything in the steps that I wouldn't have already done before. I thought I just knew enough about all that stuff, and I have a degree in theology and all sorts of God stuff, and I figured there's no way that this could enhance my life at all. And so what happened to me, and I tell you this simply because usually I find that there's at least one other person in any group I speak to who either is going through this now or will be going through it. And so I always tell it. My sponsors encourage me always to tell this. What I did was I was miserable. I mean, dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. Dying. For the first about year and a half. And one day I went down to Serenity Hall and I came in. Oh, God, I was dying. And I was always crying, too. They used to call me the crying nun. I didn't know that, but they told me this later. And this man came up to me and he said, "Bea, you know, you're always unhappy. And you look like you're, you know, you never, you just, this program," he told me that this program was intended to help us to become happy, joyous, and free. And I thought, well, you could have fooled me. I didn't get that far somehow. And he told me about where it says, you know, we absolutely insist on enjoying life and all these good little bits out of the book. And I didn't get any of that at all. So he went on to tell me that, you know, that I could be happy if I really wanted to. And then he said, "Listen, I'm going to tell you something, and this might help you." And he said, "Why didn't you go home to your convent?" This is the best bit of information I've ever been given in my whole entire life. And he said, "Kneel down and ask God to give you the willingness to change your attitude." Now, with all the pieces of paper I have in my bottom drawer, with all the lectures I'd been to and all the college courses I'd taken, with all the degrees, with all the knowledge that I had here, I had never heard anybody give me that kind of advice and saying, "Kneel down and ask God to give you the willingness to change your attitude." And I was in such pain that I just did that. I just did that. I went home and I did that. And I would love to tell you that God appeared to me and that there was an angel and there were singing and there was a rainbow and there was a burning bush and all that. None of that happened to me. But what I am here to tell you is that little by little by little, I got a little bit more willing to do this program exactly as it was designed through the steps. And it was real slow for me. Real slow. In fact, only in the last about 4 or 5 years have I begun to sort of glimpse on to what I've come to share with you this weekend. And that is the joys of the program. Now, I'm not going to tell you what they are tonight because I would love to have you back here tomorrow. But I'm basically going to tell you a couple of things, though. I have no idea, and some of you I won't see ever again, and I wish you all the wonderful things that God has in store for you, whatever that is, if you stay sober. And for those of you who are going to be here for the weekend, I know that wonderful things are going to happen here. Because one thing I know for absolutely sure, now see, I don't know hardly anything now, but this is one thing I do know. And that is that my God is always working in the strangest places, through the strangest people, in the funniest ways, in ways I would never have. And so I believe that this weekend is filled with a lot of surprises. A lot of surprises for me. A lot of surprises for you. As Candid Camera, that program, used to say, where you'd least expect it. You know, where you'd least expect it. And so I can't wait to see and hear how God is going to show off this weekend, because that's what happens in the program. God shows off. The book talks about it over and over again. It talks about God demonstrating through us. And what's demonstrating except showing off? And so what I propose that I will be doing this weekend will be, I will be going through the promises of the program with you, and some of you have done this with me before, but since I was here last year, lots of other things have happened inside of me, and while basically the message will be the same, I may be doing a few things that will be sort of different. You will recall, and you'll see it here if you look at step 12, and it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, not as any result, as the result, what happens as the result of the steps is that we wake up. You know, we really wake up. And it's the difference between becoming conscious and being awake. And we get to be alert and alive. And we get to know and to be intuitive. And one day, since I was here last year, I took the 12 and 12 and I counted the number of times in the 12 and 12 that there were promises in the 12th step, in the 12 and 12. And do you know how many promises there are in the 12th step? There are 70 in the 12th step alone. Now, what I counted in between the steps in the big book are 84 promises. There are 13 in step 3. There are 6 in step 4. There are 10 in step 5, and so on and so forth. And we're going to be rediscovering them and discovering them for the first time for some of us this weekend. But some of the promises that there are in the 12 and 12 as the result of these steps are emotional security. Is there anybody here who would like to get that this weekend? Oh, good. Okay. Wonderful energy. Anybody like a little bit of energy? Peace of mind. Hey, isn't that great stuff? We will be no longer square pegs in round holes. We fit, you know? We'll be sane and happy. Sane for this head? My God, isn't that marvelous? It promises us in step 12 a new state of consciousness. It promises us unselfishness. For somebody like me who's totally and completely self-centered, it promises a whole bunch of things, a new state of being, and that we'll be standing on the edge of new mysteries, and we'll be, all of these things will be happening to us. So I'm very interested to find out when that's and how that's going to happen. Tomorrow when and if you come here, you'll be given a little schedule. And in the schedule, you'll see tomorrow how we'll be doing everything. We'll be beginning at 9:30. And I have a little butterfly because I love Al-Anon people, and I hope there'll be lots of Al-Anons here too. At the back, I have a quote from William James, who incidentally is quoted in our big book where we talk about the variety of religious experiences. And he says, the greatest revolution in our generation is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives. Ladies and gentlemen, this weekend I invite you with me to change the inner attitudes of your minds so that you'll be able to experience the change in the outer aspects of your lives. I love you. Thank you for inviting me. God bless you.
Gives me such power.
My name is Bea and I'm a blissful alcoholic. And since you all say where you come from, I come from California. Now I come from California. I used to come from Ireland, as you can tell. I always believe in making alcoholics feel secure, so because we're basically insecure people. So what I'd like to do is go through this schedule with you for a second, just to kind of give you an idea of what we might be doing. And as a matter of fact, what I'm going to end up doing is telling you nothing, but make you feel secure anyhow. It says 9:30 begin. And I just put these times down so that I'd fill that space on the left-hand side. That's really the only reason I did that. What we're going to be doing, though, basically this morning, is we're going to be doing the promises of steps 1 through 5. And if you notice on 9:30 there, we're going to call that a new and triumphant arch because that's the first promise of step 3. And then at 10:30, we're going to be talking about the causes and conditions. That's what led us to this day in our sobriety or in our disease. And we're going to be talking about step 4 and step 5 and talking about the promises of step 4 and the promises of step 5. Now, we're having it looks like 12:30 to 1:30 lunch, and then I guess it's 12:30 to 2 lunch. And then at 2 o'clock, I call this separating the women from the girls and separating the men from the boys. Isn't that funny? Well, now, the reason that that's there is that sometimes I have somebody helping me do this little workshop. I have a priest who sometimes helps me. And what we do at that point is we have the men in one place and the women in one place, and I do the women and he does the men, and we give it to them, you know? But what we're going to... Actually, the quote separating the men from the boys, as you recognize, is from step 6 in the 12 and 12. But I'm going to do it with both of you all together, so we're going to talk about that a lot. And then we're going to do at 2:30, some of you will recall this from last year, we're going to do a new frontier emotional sobriety, and I will give you copies of Bill W.'s letter on depression. And we're going to have a little look at that and see how he found a recipe for his depressions. And then from 3 to 3:30, roughly, none of these times will probably fit exactly, so it doesn't. We're real loose about this today. We're going to have easy does it. We're going to have a time that we call God time. And that means that we're going to have a little time just by ourselves with some kind of reflection, taking a look at that article on emotional sobriety and sort of mulling through it and maybe marking it up as yours, and you can do whatever you want with it. And then at 3:30 to 4 o'clock, we're going to have a group session and ask ourselves the question that Bill talked about at the end of that letter, and he said, "And now my head has stopped racing." None of you have heads that race, I know, but I do. And he said he had found a quiet place in bright sunshine after he found the recipe for his depression. So we're going to discuss that a little bit. And then we're going to do, at 4 o'clock, we're going to do the promises of step 7 and 8. And you know the quota are these extravagant promises. It's from page 84 of the big book. And we're going to continue with our reprogramming. I'm going to tell you what that is in a little while. Then this evening, dinner's at 5. You go off and have dinner. And then at 7:30, there will be just the regular AA meeting. And David or some of you will tell you what that means. There will be various meetings here. Then on Sunday, which is tomorrow, at 9:30 we'll begin, and caution, and I can't tell you what SDRF is, because it's in your big book and you ought to know that, but if any of you guesses it, I'll give you a prize. Nobody knows. That's wonderful. That gives me great power. And that means, that means you'll come back to find out, because we're curious by nature. And then we're going to take a look at the promises of that, and then talk about step 12, giving it away. And then at 11:30, we're just going to have a kind of a quiet gratitude time where we're going to sort of reflect on what God has done for us, and then I've got a little surprise for you. So, you have to come back tomorrow, is what I'm telling you.
So with that, as we go through the day, you can ask me questions on that if you want to, or we can clarify it as we go along. Anyway, we're not going to be too particular if we don't fall into the exact time. Now, for those of you who were here last night, I made a comment, and I'll continue to make this comment because I believe it. And I don't believe in that much, but I believe in this. I believe that God continues to work. And I believe that God's with us here this morning. And if I wanted to be funny and facetious, I could say, and I believe that she has wonderful things in store for us. I say that when I'm talking to priests and bishops. They get angry with me, and I like doing that. I like getting upset. I work in a male hierarchical system, and every once in a while I get into terrible trouble over the things I do and say. What we're going to talk about this morning, I want to just give you a little focus on the whole idea of the disease. And I'm not here to teach you, because you already know this. You're here because you have this disease. So I'm not in the capacity of a teacher, but I'm just sharing with you some of the things that have been operative in my journey in sobriety. What I've discovered and what I believe most of all is that, what a friend of mine says, is that my head would destroy me completely if it didn't need me for transportation. It really would. My head would kill me if it didn't need me for transportation. And what we're going to make an effort to do this weekend is to do some reprogramming so that somehow our heads can stop racing and our disease can remain arrested. And this is where I have to jump around, George, so I hope this will work. Some of us come into this program. Is that working okay, George? Some of us, I do awfully bad with microphones. People like George get upset with me, but he won't. What we come in here with is the G word. You know what the G word is? And if you know what G... No, most of us don't have the G word.
Gratitude.
Pardon?
Gratitude.
No, most of us don't have gratitude. When we come in here, what are we filled with? We're filled with the G word. We're filled with guilt. And the reason we're filled with guilt is that we have not conceded to our innermost self, number one, that we have a disease. Just a wee bit. Thank you. We haven't conceded that we have a disease. And what we just need to look at very, very briefly for a couple of seconds is that we have a disease that has three parts. And the first part is that it's physical. And I don't know anything about this part to speak of. I just know that I went crazy. My whole body went crazy when I ingested this stuff into my system. And for some reason, and I don't understand this either, this mess up that happened inside of my system sent a message to my brain, which involved itself with the mental part of the disease. This is terribly simplistic. For those of you who are here and know this awfully well, I want to put a disclaimer out immediately, but I like to do this just to place us in the setting of the disease. So first of all, our disease is physical and is mental. And the mental part of our disease has a sentence that it says to us all the time. And it still does, in a sense, in some capacity or other. And it says, I want more. Say that to yourselves, have you? I want more, I need more, I've got to get more. Of whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's never enough. I never have enough of anything, whatever it is. And I will do anything I can. I will go to any lengths to get whatever it is that I need in this disease. This disease tells me I can't have one drink or one fix or one whatever. So I have to have more. And then I have this bright idea in my head, and I'll say, oh, I know what I'll do when I think I'm into excess in this disease. I'll start using this great thing that I thought I had, which was called willpower. Did any of you try that stuff? And when I put that in quotes too, because we don't have that when it comes to our drinking and our using. And then when we found that our willpower didn't work, we got very depressed, and we went back to the physical part again. We said, oh, well, just this one time, I'll try it again, you know. So our heads were racing. And what we didn't know about ourselves, none of this we knew, was that we had a spiritual malady. We didn't know this. And our spiritual malady also has a voice. And the voice that our spiritual malady says, our soul sickness, as some people call it, it says,
I can do this by myself. In other words, I can play God, I can be God, I am God. We don't say it in those words, but we really don't want help. I don't want you to help me. I am self-sufficient. I am the higher power. So when we understand that this disease has these three components, and that we're kind of, it's like if I were to go down here to Barbara and I were to get her by the back of the neck like this, and I'd say, Barbara, I have Barbara in. It's like being in the grip of a progressive illness, and our illness gets worse and it never gets better. And what I've learned for 11 and a half years sober, and some of you are far longer sober than that, but I've learned that I have to be constantly vigilant with my head, with my disease. Because our book tells me that sometimes we can deliberately set ourselves up to get drunk. It says that, I think it's on page 37 or 39, I can never remember which one. It says in some circumstances we've deliberately set ourselves out to get drunk. And it's very clear on what that is. It says we can get into nervousness, anger, worry, depression, or jealousy and the like. I love the way the book is, and the like, etc. You know, that we can get into that sort of stuff. So what I understand now about me and about the disease and about the program is that we have to be in constant vigilance. I would never have stayed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous if I didn't discover it to be constantly exciting, because I like excitement. I get high in excitement. And this program has never gotten boring for me yet. Now, the day it gets boring, I won't be coming back. You know, I won't be around anymore. But I constantly learn more and more things. You look like a very accepting kind of a group, so I'm going to just tell it to you exactly like I think it is and like it is. And so what I'm going to be talking about is several pieces of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I specifically want to look at page 60 in the Big Book, if you have it there. I guess, I think what I'm going to need is something. Larry, did you say that paper towels would clean that up a little better for me? Could you get me that, please?
Thank you.
And incidentally, as you go through this day, you may have questions. And since I know the answer to everything, and if I don't know the answer to everything, I'll make it up. David over here, where are you, David? David's in charge. He's the boss of the Ask It Basket. And we have an Ask It Basket back there on the table. So if you want to write a question, you know, about the steps or the program, or just don't ask me how old I am, for God's sakes. Well, no, Larry, you don't have to do it to perfection, sweetheart. Would you like to hire a cleaning service here for me? No, because I just wanted to sort of, just that middle part over there. That's good.
You want a border?
Gee, this is great. I could have you every place I go. It's wonderful. So David's in charge of the Ask It Basket, so you put your questions in there, and periodically through the day we'll try to answer some of those questions, and if I don't know the answers, you can help me. But what I want to look at is, you know, the real heart and the real core of this disease, which our book tells us constantly is self-will run riot, but we don't know that. We know that there's a physical part that upsets our whole chemistry, and we know there's a spiritual part. But the whole business about self-will running riot, thank you, Larry, is really hard. So at the bottom of page 60, if you look at that paragraph, it says that the first requirement, the first thing that we're going to need to understand is that we're convinced that any life on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with somebody or something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion, and each person is like an actor. Now, I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to read it again, and I'll tell you why, because sometimes people don't get it. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Now, listen to me reading this again, and it'll be a little different. Each person is like an actress who wants to run the whole show. She's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in her own way. If her arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as she wished, the show would be great. Now listen to this. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his or own, her own way. If Carol's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Teresa wished, the show would be great. Now, what I'm inviting you to do today is to put your own name into that big book, because this big book wasn't written for them. I mean, it was. But it was written for me. And in case you're wondering about that, for those of you who might have some kind of religious background, and I have, you know, religious backgrounds don't mean a thing to me, but scripturally, in the whole Old Testament, God always calls everybody by their name. And I believe that this program calls us by our name and invites us personally to become really involved with this program. Until I found that first secret out, I couldn't catch on to anything because I was always judging everybody else. I'm not here to judge anybody. I'm here to do this program for me, you know. And so I have to keep reminding myself that this is about me trying to run the whole show. Everybody, including B, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, B may sometimes be quite virtuous. She may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, and even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, she may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, she is more likely to have varied traits. So when we personalize the program and put it into, you know, what it is for us now today, that makes a lot more sense, I think, to me for sure. And then what usually happens, it doesn't come off or go off as well as we thought. And the quote that I used last night, am I not, or is she not, or is he not, a victim of the delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? If only I worked harder, if only I could fix it to go exactly as it was supposed to go, then it would just be fine. And so, what we get to understand through taking a look at step three is that our basic problem is what we call in the book, as we say the third step prayer, we call it a sort of a bondage. It's called the bondage of ourselves. And we're encased and encrusted in that bondage, whether we like it or not, most of the time. I often say that I don't think I ever had one pure motive in my life. I'm saying that just as I'm standing here. I don't think I ever had a motive that didn't have some part of me in it. It's real hard. And what the program does, especially through step three, is that it releases us somewhat from the bondage of ourselves and got us into some kind of a spiritual stance or mindset or awakening or way that where we can be with God. The real problem continues to be described to us on page 62. And if you just look at this, I think I probably did tell you this last year, but I can't remember, and many of you weren't here last year, but the very top of the page there, even though it's out of context, I think is at the heart of the program. If the rest of the world would only behave. God! If they will only do it the way they're supposed to do it. Did you ever? You never felt like that, did you? You never felt like when you're driving on the freeway that if it just would move over, if your boss would do this, if your family would do that, if you could just get them to do it, and we try in every manipulative kind of way to get them to do it the way they're supposed to, and they won't do it. God, isn't that awful? Now, I'm going to tell you something. Now, I'll be leaving here tomorrow, so you can talk about me when I leave. Would you do that? Just don't do what I'm here, because I'm extremely sensitive. There's a buzzword that they're using a lot of in California right now. And I didn't come to talk about this real specifically, but sometimes people in AA get very upset when I do this. But I'm going to do it here. I'm going to talk to you just a wee bit about the buzzword of the 90s. Actually, it was in the 80s too, but it's really becoming the buzzword of the 90s. And it's the word codependency. You never heard it here, did you? In this? No? No? Oh, okay. Some people may get upset. As a matter of fact, in the meeting I go to, we talk about it, but we call it the C word. Well, you know what I believe now, and I found this out all by my little self when I was reading all this literature here, and I've read a lot of literature on codependency. What do you think this page 62 is about? Isn't that top line there, if the rest of the world would only behave? It's a real definition for the codependency. And what I'm led to believe is that, I don't know about you guys, I don't know how you are about it, but I think my basic problem was that. I think my basic problem was that they wouldn't do it the way they were supposed to. My basic problem was codependency. And by the grace of God, I found alcohol. That sounds terrible, but it's true. I found alcohol. And then it brought me to the point where I needed to get some help. See? And that, I believe, is real operative. Because, you see, on page 62, it talks about selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, self-pity. The word self on page 62 is written 13 times. Now, you might be able to find 14 times if you do tell me, because I'm always trying to do to find out new things about this. But what it basically says is that we alcoholics are an extreme example of self-will run riot, though we don't think so. And we have to get rid of this selfishness, and only God can make that possible. And God will help us to get rid of our self-centeredness. We can't do it by ourselves. And then the famous last paragraph on page 62, it says, "Be," and put your own name in there. Put your own name. Jane, Mary, whatever your name is. David, Bob, Robbie. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God because, you know what? It didn't work. It doesn't work. And next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, that God was going to be our director. And he's the principal and we're his agents, and he's the father and we're his kids, we're his children. And it says to me, most good ideas are simple, B. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which you, B, are going to pass to freedom. But remember that if you complicate it, you probably will miss it, because I tend to complicate everything. The first promise of step 3 is at the bottom of page 62. Many of you found that out before. The first promise is that if we let go and we let God, and we let God be God instead of us playing God, which is, as far as I know, the original sin, that if we do that, then we would be able to discover the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we'll pass to freedom. I like to put these promises in the present tense because I believe that they were written to be operative for me now, today. And I think our founders wanted us that to happen too. The second promise of step 3 is that when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I think that's real classy. You know, remarkable things for me is when I get a good night's sleep that I got last night. A wonderful night's sleep. God. No interruptions, no telephone calls, nothing. Wonderful. No anxiety attacks. No waking up at 2:12 with cold sweats and dying for a drink. That's remarkable for me to... Remarkable. Remarkable for me to be able to arrive yesterday at Dallas Airport and appreciate the beautiful Lady Carol here who met me with a flower and some lemonade. God, a drink. You know, she brought a drink for me to the airport. Isn't that great? Now, that's classy. You know, I mean, that's real classy. And then we talk, under traffic, out of the traffic. You know, we just talk the whole way back. I've known Kara since last year. And then another time I flew into Dallas, she and a friend of hers came out and met me in Dallas when I had a little time to spend here. I go through Dallas a lot, by the way. I go through Dallas a lot, so I'll be calling you up to meet me and talk to me when I'm dying over there in that airport. It's a terrible airport. Lost all over the place. But to be able to appreciate that, that's remarkable for me, to be able to notice, you know, that's happening. To be able to get up this morning bright and to swim in a freezing cold pool and love it and say, thanks be to God. Thanks be to God for the air and the sun that came this morning. Thanks be to God for your faces and your energy and your life and all that's going on inside of you. And, you know, I believe that life is a combination of human beings who are permeated by some kind of sustained energy, which I believe comes from a higher power. And there's a lot of sustained energy here. I feel a lot of energy. And for me, even to know any of that is a remarkable thing, and to be able to feel it and appreciate it. So that's the second promise. Then the third promise is that we have a new employer. We're no longer our own employers, or we're no longer really subservient to another kind of an employer. God's the one that's in charge of it all, everything. God's in charge of our jobs, our families, our relationships, our little things, big things, in-between things. God's in charge of the whole thing. And this interesting part about this higher power, this God, is that he happens to be all-powerful. And he'll provide what we need if we keep close to him and perform his work well. I used to think, now, I wonder what that means, performing his work well. Well, what I know now is that, this works like a charm. Maybe it's the pen. What I know for me is that God's work for me is basically to stay sober. Now, when I say stay sober, I mean not drinking and not using any kind of drugs. Basically, bottom line, that's what that means. But for me, it also means that I stay comfortable, that I stay sitting in my own skin. There's a great difference, I think, between staying dry and staying sober. You know, we can just not drinking. I did that lots of times, I would swear off it. I do that lots of times in sobriety, just into dryness. Great difference between being life-giving, being awake and alert and conscious and sober and experiencing the joys of living. And I believe that that's what God wants me to be. God wants me to be sober. And sober for me means experiencing life, being comfortable. Now, I'm not comfortable 24 hours of any day. I'm really not. Because things happen to me. I go to the bank. I think I told you this last year. It's gotten worse. I go into the bank. And you know what they do in the bank in California? They're always training a new girl. They are always training a new girl. Honest to God, this happens to me all the time. And she always has long earrings, and she has, you know, long eyelashes, and she has long hair. She's cute as a button. But she doesn't know anything, folks. God, she doesn't know anything. And I'm standing in line, L-I-N-E line, and I'm always in a hurry, you know, and I have to wait. And when I get to her, and we've been going to that same bank for 25 years, and we have very little money in it, but we go there anyway, and she asks me, this new girl, every week, every time, asks me the same question. And she says to me, ma'am, do you have an account here? Ooh, that's called agitation, you know? Now, I'm talking about handling life, you know? And that's what I think staying sober means, being able to handle life. This happened to me just the other day, again. It happens to me all the time in the bank for some reason. And the post office, too. That's another place. And she said to me, after I didn't tell her how to run the bank, and I waited and I breathed in and out and I said the Serenity Prayer and I said the third step prayer and I hung on to my nails and I had big marks on my hands from my nails, digging into my hands, oh God, please don't let me disgrace myself in public and take, you know, just tell everybody here how to do it and what to do and where to put it, etc., you know. And when I got to her, she said, thank you very much for your patience because I knew. Well, I knew she was new because they're always new. And so then because she looked so terribly forlorn and lost and all, then I immediately became her mother, you know.
I told her what to do, and I said, now just do everything they tell you to do, just go through all the procedures. I suddenly then became my total codependent self. Now, that's a silly little example, but I'm telling you, staying sober means like doing living, doing life, you know, doing life with some kind of grace and some kind of class. And so the promise is that God will provide me what I need if I stay close to Him, conscious contact, and perform His work there. And His work is to stay sober and to carry the message. Now I get to carry the message formally in a way like this, and you get to carry the message formally and informally. You get to carry the message by service. You get to carry the message on your jobs, in your homes. I get to carry the message when I work with my bishop, and I could call him another name, but I won't, because this is on tape. Sometimes he doesn't know what he's doing. And I think I should tell him. You know what I mean? I should tell him. And when I can be graceful and classy and behave myself, like my sponsor Mary Ann says, be all you have to do today is behave. That's what an order. I can't go through with that. Hard. Really hard. Anyway, that's one of the promises of step three, that he's going to perform, he's going to do whatever it is that I need. He's going to perform what it is if I do his work well and I stay sober and carry the message. A miracle happens in this other promise. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. We're encrusted naturally and basically in the bondage of ourselves. And if we can move out of that bondage of ourselves, even slightly, it's a miracle, I believe. And our own little plans and designs. Did you ever do plans and designs in your heads and results, you know? Your little plots, you know, different from real plots. Oh, and it thickens as the day goes on. And as the night sets in, boy, it gets good. Plot. You're going to get him and get her, and you're going to say this, and you're going to say that, and then I'm going to fix this, and then you're going to move there, and then we're going to put this over here, and then I'll probably do our little plans and designs. We get out of that, the book promises us. And then we become more and more interested in what we can contribute to life, how we can give instead of get. That's not natural to us. And then what happens is that we start feeling this new power flowing in. Now remember, I'm inviting you to put this into the present tense because I firmly believe that's what our founders meant, that we would use this to work for us, not something that happened way back in a historical event. Yes, it was an historical event, but this book is for me and my sobriety today, you know. So what I have to do is let myself feel this new power flowing in. Joying peace of mind. Good night's sleep, you know. My head's not racing. I'm not out to get anybody. God, that's a miracle. And I discover that I can face life successfully. That's a good one. You know, because they always knew whoever they were that I could. I didn't know this, but they did. Did you ever hear your parents or your teachers or somebody saying to you, you're not performing according to your potential? That awful word, whatever the heck potential is, I'm not sure. But you know, they were always telling us we never did it exactly. We never quite measured up. And we always believed that. And some of us still do. And what this promise is that we discover, the most important word in that whole sentence is that we do it. We discover that we can face life successfully. Because they always knew about us. They knew we had a lot of drive, a lot of success. We could do stuff and we could get things done. Usually we're go-getters in AA. We're usually a lot of go-getters here. But we didn't know that about ourselves because our self-esteem was so low. We didn't have any, no confidence, no self-esteem. We became conscious of God's presence, not only when we were in big trouble, but all the time, at different times. We were able to appreciate things and understand things. And then we began to lose our fear of today and tomorrow and the hereafter. That's a marvelous promise, to be able to lose our fear of God. When we start doing step four later this morning, we'll talk a little bit about what that does to it. It talks about it being the corroding thread that shot through the fabric of our being. This fear, the nameless, groundless fears, and we don't know what they're from. We don't know why. Sometimes we wake up in the morning with them, or sometimes everything's going fine. Suddenly we're in fear. God, what a word. It grips us. Now if you stay this morning, I'm going to be teaching you the fear prayer. On page 68 is a really wonderful, wonderful prayer. But anyway, there are 13 promises in step 3. And I believe that there are no accidents. I believe there are no coincidences in this program at all, no coincidences at all. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to break up into groups. And I'm going to give each of you a promise of step 3 that I, those of you here last year will know that I did this. And in this little envelope, there's a promise of step 3. And on the top of your envelope, there's a number. Tricky, huh? And whatever your number says, that means that that's the group you're in. David, would you tell everybody who the group facilitators or leaders are? And if you could possibly then tell them where the places are.
Generally, two groups will meet in this room, one in this east room, one in the Alatine room, which is back here, one in the non-smoking room here, and one in the lounge. The Al-Anon room will be kept open for our regular meetings that will be ongoing during the day. So let me introduce our facilitators for each of the groups. Those with the number one and the, will be with Sana. Sana, will you stand? And that will be back in this area where Sana is of this room. And those with number six will also be in this room, and that's Robbie. Robbie, will you stand? And Robbie's group will meet over in this area near George over here. Those with number two will be with Kelly. Kelly, where are you? Kelly's in the non-smoking room, and that's where her group will meet, in the non-smoking room. Those with number three will be with Carol. Carol, stand up. And Carol will be in the lounge, back in the, our lounge. Those with number four will be with Theresa. Theresa, back here. And Theresa's group, number four, will meet in the Alatine room behind here. And those with number five will be with Grace. Where's Grace? Grace, okay. And Grace's group will meet in this room here, this east room on this side. Since there'll be a mixture of smokers and non-smokers in these groups, we ask that the discussion meetings will be non-smoking, if you would mind refraining from smoking just during the discussion meetings. Otherwise, smoking's permitted in here, as you know. So, but if you would just refrain, we mix the non-smokers and smokers, it makes it easier. So we'll do it that way. Okay?
Okay, David, thank you. Now, I'm not through with my announcements yet. So can you keep in mind where you're supposed to be? And if you get lost, don't worry, because we'll tell you. And at the end of the group session, what I'll do is, like I did last year, I will, let me see if I can find this now, go around with this little bell and tell you that I need you back to order here, which is in the large group again, okay? So you know it's over. I kind of have to sort of play this by ear according as the group is going. Now, you're going to be doing three things in your group, and your group facilitators are extremely well-trained. We had a training session last night, very lengthy training session, and they know exactly what they have to do. The first thing they do is you will be praying, you'll say a little prayer together, maybe the Serenity Prayer or the Third Step Prayer, whatever you want to do. And then the second thing you'll do is you will share whatever promise that you got out of this little envelope. And the facilitators happened to get this ahead of time, so I hope they didn't look last night. Robbie, are you sure? I don't trust... He's a Catholic priest, you know that, don't you? Father Robbie? He didn't... he dresses like one, that's why I thought you were one, Robbie. You will get your little promise in there from the third step. Now, this is where I want you to listen very hard. I told you that my mind was out to get me or it would destroy me if it didn't need me for transportation. So it's really important to me that I continue to reprogram my mind. And so what I want to talk to you a little bit about now before you do this, I want to talk to you about the idea of formulating affirmations. Have you ever heard the word affirmations before? Where you affirm yourself. You affirm yourself, and if you keep affirming yourself enough and saying a positive statement to yourself using an I message, I do this and I, whatever it is, I enjoy peace of mind. I am conscious of God's presence. I can face life successfully. I am losing my fear of today. I am losing my fear of tomorrow. You know, and formulating an affirmation. That way, I can start changing what goes on between my ears. And so in your groups, the third part of your group is that on the large sheets of paper, Teresa, she has under her chair here, each group leader will have a large sheet of paper and some marking pens. So you're going to formulate, using the promises of step three, some affirmations, maybe two or three or five or ten, you know, using whatever you want. Now, if you get stuck on that, or if you're not sure exactly how to do that, I'm going to be moving around the groups, and your facilitators will help you. And when we come back, we want to put these affirmations around the place so that we can see them. And then I want to collate all these affirmations for you and let you have them all at the end so that we'll be able to have something to hold on to. We'll be doing all the affirmations out of the promises of the steps. But I've never done this with a large group before, so I want you to be my guinea pigs. So will you do that for me so we can get all these affirmations together? Now, I'm going to pass out these promises, so I'm going to need some help.